CliffCentral.com.
That's right, that's Stevie Wonder with Superstition. CliffCentral.com. Wednesday morning. All across South Africa, people are still in lockdown. If you're feeling a bit of cabin fever, it's not just you. We've decided we're going to check in with some of our favorite people over the next few days. And, I mean, they're all keen because they got nothing else to do. That's what's going on. So one of those people is Eleanor Williams, who we know from when she was at the British Trade Commission. And since then, she's decided to make South Africa her home. She and I share a common ancestry from Jamaica. And we had Eleanor on the show not so long ago when we had Pumi in the studio, and we had a great time, and we thought, let's check in with her. She's in Cape Town at the moment. Hey, Eleanor, how are you?
Good morning, team. And first of all, thank you guys for keeping going. You've been providing some of my sanity every morning and a bit of normality in what is a completely abnormal time. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. And how are you doing? I mean, are you locked down on your own? Are you with other people? Whereabouts are you exactly?
I am locked down on my own in the Cape Town CBD. So, and I don't mind. I mean, I'm used to spending a lot of time on my own, so it's not unusual for me. I think the only thing that I'm missing is I'm quite tactile. I like to touch people.
Yeah.
So in the time of Corona, that's really, you know, impossible. So I'm missing out on a bit of physical contact, but otherwise I'm okay. I'm very busy.
You are one of those rare people who actually does a lot for other people, and you don't talk about it. So I'm going to talk about it for you, but you've got an organization called Ladies of Love, and you guys provide meals to homeless people and some schools. And with the coronavirus outbreak, you've been providing 2,000 meals a day. Just tell me how that works.
Yeah, so the Ladles of Love is a soup kitchen that's based in town, quite close to Parliament, set up by an amazing guy called Daddy. And normally providing 400 meals a day to homeless people, but also some schools within the city. They've now had to ramp that up to 2,000 meals a day, working with the city of Cape Town and some other charities and NGOs, in tandem with the city setting up some homeless shelters. So what I've been doing is kind of reaching out across my networks to get people to help donate things that are needed for both the kitchen and the homeless shelters. So, for example, yesterday, an amazing guy called Yuri from Vector Logistics responded to a tweet of mine where I was asking for 250 wooden pallets to be used for beds within the shelters. Oh, so man. Yuri responded to that and delivered those to one of the shelters for us.
Wow.
Paul Kluver Wines responded to me requiring 100 kilograms of apples. So one day it could be, you know, pallets. Another day it's apples. Today I'm hunting down blankets and possibly tents as well. So we're busy. We're really busy.
It's amazing how even though things are really tough for a lot of people and businesses are going through tough times, there are still good people who are willing to find you 100 kilograms of apples.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've been blown away by people's generosity. You know, I've got people lined up who said, well, I haven't got a physical thing to give, but if you need something and somebody's not willing to donate it, I'll pay for it. So just let me know what you need. So that's amazing. And then the other thing that I'm working on, which is equally important, if not, you know, more pressing for people and their families, I'm working with the South African Chamber of Commerce in London. I mean, I sit on their executive committee, so I'm part of that. Mm-hmm. And the South African High Commission. So High Commissioner Thembi Tambo and my counterpart, Hayley Reichert, are working on repatriating South Africans from the UK back to South Africa. So there are 190 South Africans who are stuck in the UK at the moment. 30 of them were cruise ship passengers who've been put into quarantine. And the other 160 of people who went to the airport on the, you know, at the airport the night before lockdown, trying to get out and couldn't get out. So I'm working with them to try to get those people home.
Where are these people staying in the meantime? Are they in hotels? Are they able to pay for that? I mean, how does it work?
That's a really good question. So some of them are in hotels. Some of them are staying with kind South Africans in the UK who've responded to a plea to kind of house some of them. And some people, I suspect, are still in the hotel, in the airport. So it's quite a difficult time for them. And Haley and Tembi Tambo are also part of a global network of people who are trying to get South Africans from around the world back. So yesterday you had somebody talking about a person who's stuck in Vietnam. Yeah. Well, there's actually 50 South Africans stuck in Vietnam, and they are quickly running out of money, you know, food, accommodation, and they're coming up against some what's considered to be anti-Western sentiment. So they're considered to be Westerners, and there's, you know, anti-Western sentiment. So, you know, it's quite urgent. But I guess one of the challenges, you know, the British High Commissioner was on the news a lot yesterday talking about the progress that has been made in getting the government to agree to flights now, but they've got some roadblocks. So one of the roadblocks is literally the road. So they haven't been able to forge a way and agree how to physically move people from where they are in South Africa, for example, to one of the big three airports. So how do you get a guy who's in Knysna to Cape Town Airport during lockdown when nobody's allowed on the road? And they just haven't agreed that yet. They're still debating it. It's something I think they were trying to work through overnight. So those kind of logistical things are problematic. One of the things I've been doing, and I'm sure I'm never going to be able to say this again in my life, but somebody has given me a hotel.
Wow.
And I'll never be able to say that again. So when we're talking about the generosity
You're not talking about a Monopoly hotel.
I'm talking about a physical hotel with 100 rooms that can be used for quarantining the South Africans when they arrive back in South Africa. So when I say give, they're, you know, making the hotel available, we've still got to find out how to pay for it, because none of this stuff is free.
Yeah.
And the government is obviously stretched. So we've got to work out, how do you pay for, you know, 190 South Africans who are going to be holed up in quarantine for at least 2 weeks?
Wow. Thank God people like you are looking out for this, because I don't know what I would do. Yes, it's just amazing how much pressure this puts on people. And you really see some incredible human beings rise to the challenge and just take on more than their own problems. And then there are those who just are so consumed by their own problems that they can't get away from that. And they're just unable to even sort out tiny little things in their life. How are you keeping, you said we're keeping you sane, but what else are you doing to keep sane during all of this? You're just keeping busy by the sound of things.
I'm keeping busy because I also have some work to do that I'm paid for. So, I heard you guys talking about it the other day, like taking naps during the day.
Yeah.
So I've been doing that to kind of regulate my energy, because actually all this work is giving me, I just perennially have a headache at the moment. So taking naps during the day, and because I will be on a WhatsApp call with somebody at 2 o'clock in the morning. So just trying to regulate that way. Oh gosh, the thing that's giving me life, and I was talking to Sia about this yesterday and I chastised
her. Oh, here she goes.
Tiger King on Netflix.
Okay, you can explain this to me. I've seen all the memes, but I don't know what the hell this is about. So just explain to me, who is this Carol, whatever her name is, and what's the story? Please.
I am so disgusted with all of you for not being keeping up with the zeitgeist.
All right, help us. Get us on board.
Okay, so there's Joe Exotic, who is the most redneck of rednecks, mullet-haired, you know, meth-consuming, homosexual, married to two straight men.
Wow.
Yeah. And he is the guy who has the exotic animals, and he has this kind of park, and, you know, he has this business. He entertains people with his exotic animals. And then he has his arch nemesis, Carol Baskins, who presents herself as, you know, animal welfare person, you know, animal rights, rescues the cats and has her own kind of cat sanctuary. But she has a secret. Uh-huh. So Carol is a very ambitious woman, and she likes money. And so her second husband was a very wealthy man. He disappeared. Ooh. Her husband disappeared clean off the face of the earth.
Yeah.
And the story goes that she killed him and fed him to one of the tigers. Right. So this guy, Joe Exotic, his whole purpose in life was about bringing down Carol Baskins because she was trying to shut him down. So he became unhealthily obsessed with her, including coming up with a plot to try to kill her.
And Eleanor, before you even carry on, this is a true story. This is not some...
It's true. As true as I'm talking to you now, this is true. This guy, Joe Exotic, is languishing in jail, serving 25 years for this conspiracy to kill Carol.
Good.
But all the twists and turns are just... like, you just think this can't be real. Every episode you watch, you're like, no.
So she is supposed to have fed her ex-husband, dead husband, to the tigers. And then this Joe Exotic guy is supposed to be trying to kill her. And that's why he's in jail.
Absolutely.
Wow.
And it's just...
a bizarre situation.
It's just messy. It is so messy. But that's why you've got all of these memes and people... there's a cult around it because it's just nuts.
That's amazing.
But it's great. It's great at this time where we're trying to get away from and distract ourselves from Corona. So if you need a distraction, get onto Netflix, Tiger King. I promise you, you will not be disappointed.
It's like the number one watched thing in South Africa right now.
Really? I'm going to take responsibility for that because it was like at number 7 or 8. And then we just kind of went a bit nuts about it on Facebook and Twitter. And so yesterday it went up to number 1. So I'm taking credit for that.
I'm going to have to watch this now. This is hilarious. All right, Eleanor, thank you so much. It's lovely to talk to you and keep up the good work that you're doing in Cape Town. And thank you for helping all of us in South Africa to get back here if we've been stuck in the UK. And for those people who are living in Cape Town and depend on your soup kitchen and the other good people who work there. And, you know, the guy who came up with the idea, who's he? You said Daddy.
Danny Diliberto.
Great. Give him some kudos from us as well. It's great that there are people who aren't just thinking of themselves in this situation. Superb.
Thank you, guys.
All right, Eleanor. Thank you. Wow.
She's a tiger queen.
How's that story, huh?
It's outrageous.
Jesus.
That is outrageous, man.
And it's not made up. It's real.
Yes. All right. Just seeing the memes and whatnot that have come out of this series is just ridiculous.
That's crazy. Okay, we're going to talk to Pamina Bora, who is the Secretary General of the Italian Chamber, in a moment. What are some of the plans and support structures that Italy has planned for the coronavirus, and how are these going to affect you? All eyes are in Italy right now, the likes of the Italian Chamber, a non-profit organization that supports the Italian South African business community and assists with commercial ventures between the two countries, is what we're talking about. Pamina Bora is the Chamber's Secretary General and is going to give us some insight into what the way forward might be. So if you have some questions for her, you can always send those to us on the WhatsApp, which is on 0797482090. Someone said they love the Stevie Wonder song. It's made them feel better this morning. Good. Every little bit helps, right? And then someone saying in response to Gord talking about his new language of Wankanese, I think. Wanking is apparently not the capital of China.
Okay. Just to clear that up.
In case there's anyone who thought Wanking was the capital of China, no, it isn't.
All right. Good to know.
All right. And then somebody else saying that post that I read from Instagram that actually ruined, they'll never be able to hear ever again after hearing that nonsense. So, all right, let's go to Pamina, who's on the line. Pamina, thank you so much for making some time for us today. Are you also under lockdown? Where are you?
Yes, I'm safely at home. Thank you.
Good. Well, I'm very pleased you could join us this morning. Italy's obviously taken the real brunt of this in Europe, and particularly Bergamo in Lombardy. When you talk to people, and we've spoken to one or two South Africans who are in Italy, but you are in some ways with the chamber, the Italian chamber, you guys are connected to so many more people. How are people communicating at the moment? What is the situation? What stories have you heard? How many Italian South Africans are connected to families in places like Bergamo, and what's going on?
So in Bergamo specifically, we actually had an intern at our chamber that left just before the borders were closed. So we had a lot of insider information on how families were really suffering, on how people have to say goodbye from a distance to the elderly that are dying. And the images and the stories that are coming out of that are really heartbreaking. So as a chamber, apart from being connected to the local businesses, we're obviously also in touch with all the other Italian stakeholders, meaning the embassy, meaning the Italian community. And it's a really, really rough time.
It sounds really tough. And I know that Italy has taken a hard knock from all of this, but there must be lessons that we've learnt that Italy can pass on to us, because we're only at the start of our curve. And I know America's at the moment starting to accelerate as well. What kinds of lessons have we learnt there that we may be able to implement here in order to avert similar disasters?
So the number one lesson is probably that this is something that really has to be taken seriously, and that unless actions are taken and taken early, the consequences are really catastrophic. So it is really a positive thing. And to be honest, there isn't always much positive in South African politics, but it was a positive thing that our government and our president reacted fast and decisively. So other lessons that we can learn, and I'm obviously talking to you from a business point of view, is that the economy absolutely needs support, not only during the crisis, but we have to really plan for what comes after this. Because as rough as it is right now, we are going to eventually come out of this crisis. Now, how long this will take and how unscathed or damaged we come out of it really depends on the actions that are taken today. So Italy has also taken emergency measures. For example, additional funding for the health system, which is crucial when you're out of resources and you don't have enough people and equipment to deal with the sick. Also, they have instituted support for employees so that jobs can be retained, and we're seeing the same thing happening in South Africa as well, which is laudable. And the support in Italy, interestingly, also includes freelancers, of which there are really a lot of. Mm. Then it also, the support measures include an injection of liquidity into households and businesses through payment holidays, which is extremely important, because imagine, even locally, imagine someone in the hospitality or events industry or any of the industries that have been completely wiped out by this crisis.
Yeah.
There is no way they can meet their payment obligations, pay their staff. And even if you lock down a facility completely, you still have costs. You still have to pay your insurance. You may have a landlord. You've got security staff that you've got to pay. You've got all your subscriptions, your software, your telephone licenses, etc., that come off as a debit order every month. And you will pay these whether your business is open and you're generating revenue or not. So that is the sad reality.
Tell me quickly about the Italian Chamber in South Africa and what your work entails and who you represent.
Okay, so the Italian Chamber was established in 1983, mm-hmm, by a group of local Italian South African entrepreneurs. So these were first and second generation entrepreneurs that came from Italy or from Italian families and had businesses here. It was established as a non-profit company with members. And then a few years later, it was recognized by the Italian government, by the Ministry of Economic Development. So typically, the chamber has a role of supporting members and representing the business interest of the specific community or category that they represent. So in our case, it's the Italian and South African business relationship. Our main aim is really to promote bilateral trade.
Right,
and we do that through a range of information services. We do that through a service where we
It seems that you are you covering your microphone on your phone? Oh, there we go. That's better.
Is that better? Okay.
Yeah.
We do that by looking for potential business partners for Italian companies that want to enter the South African market and vice versa. We also look for investment partners. We work very closely with the South African institutions such as the DTI and various industry associations. So this is in a nutshell what we do. However, in this time of crisis, there is obviously a bigger focus on the support element and on really becoming a channel of verified information, right, which is very important.
Yeah.
Because what's flying around on WhatsApp, and I don't know how many platforms you're on, but yesterday alone, I was on Google Hangout, I was on Skype, I was on Teams, I was on Zoom, WhatsApp, email, you name it, I've been there. So it can be quite exhausting. And there is so much information being circulated. And it's really important to verify what is official and what isn't.
Yeah, there's a lot of fake news, and it makes people even more anxious. And sometimes they make decisions based on bad information. And then, you know, the costs are very real.
Exactly. So, for example, we've set up a portal on our website where we are publishing all the official information. And in this particular situation, it's very important for businesses to know what they need to do. So, for example, if there is a call for PPE, for protective equipment, it is important that that gets filtered through to the right businesses that can actually respond to that call. If there is a UIF claim to be made in a specific way, it's important for businesses to know what the deadlines are and how they apply. So all of that information is what we channel.
Well,
and yeah.
No. I'm very much aware of the time because we've got quite a lot to squeeze in this morning. But I appreciate very much, Pamina, you talking to us this morning. And thank you for the work that you and the Italian Chamber are doing, not just for the Italian community, but for South Africa, because having this route to useful information is, I think, very, very handy at this time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That's Pamina Bora, who's the Secretary General of the Italian Chamber. She joined us this morning via Google Hangout. And as she says, we're all using all these different platforms at the moment to be able to do all these different things. And I had to try Microsoft Teams for the first time yesterday. Never used that before. Have you ever used that, Sia?
No, how did that go? What's the difference with it? That's another thing that I'm not really getting with these platforms.
I had to download a thing called Cisco Systems the day before because I had to speak to a friend of mine in Canada, and he uses that. So many different platforms that people are using. Now, the sound you are hearing is the sound of Timothy Maurice sipping coffee in his house. I notice you've got exactly the same little mug that I have. I love New York City mug. Are you using that on purpose?
No, you know what? A friend of mine stayed with me about a year ago, and he brought it as a gift. And no. Okay. It was the first thing I grabbed.
I used mine in an effort of showing some solidarity to the rest of America.
So, first of all,
Timothy, how the hell are you, my friend? We haven't seen you in a long time, and we haven't had you on the show for too long. You're no stranger to us. You're always one to provide sobering insight and analysis with situations that we're all going through. And we have no doubt that you're going to shed some light this morning on some of the biggest news that we're all dealing with.
Yeah, I've been watching too much porn, Gareth.
Good man.
That's a plot twist.
That's another thing. We also like that you're so honest, you know?
You know how I stumbled on this? What happened was... One of my favorite scientist researchers is Christopher Ryan. He wrote the book Sex at Dawn.
Yeah.
It's probably the most intense, rigorous book about, you know, the science of sex.
Wow.
And Christopher Ryan.
Okay.
And in fact, he has a really popular podcast as well called Tangentially Yours.
Huh.
But anyway, he is the leading go-to researcher scientist on sex, and he really sort of introduced the concept of women, bonobos, and how potentially women could take over, and the fact that they could mate with each other to reduce patriarchy's power. It's incredible stuff.
Huh.
So what happened was I stumbled on one of his podcast conversations with a woman named Holly Randall on a podcast called Unfiltered. I just sent you the link to this.
Mm-hmm.
And their conversation was gripping because Holly, she's not a porn actress, but she shoots porn.
Wow.
So I'd never heard of her before. And their conversation led me down this rabbit hole where she basically interviews the top porn stars and goes behind the scenes. And I cannot believe how intelligent these people are. I'll give you an example. So Angela White, who is a major porn star from Australia, has a PhD.
Hang on, I'm going to Google her right now. Angela White.
Angela White. Dude, okay. Be careful. You're about to go down a journey you may not return from. Like, it's unbelievable.
She's got a PhD?
This woman, she did research on how entering porn evolves your sexual mating patterns.
She has got some enormous, enormous breasts.
Enormous brains.
Holy shit.
You're wanting to say.
Look at this woman. All right. Gareth. So she's got a, what has she written in her PhD about?
It's about how porn stars, when they enter the industry, they come in with a serious kind of conviction around their sexuality. And as they begin to explore the space, they see sort of this natural evolution. And she's really interested, obviously, in the evolution of women particularly. Mm-hmm. So what happens is, what I got caught up in was the contrast between their real selves and ultimately how they perform. Now, I want you to listen to an interview of hers first, where she talks about her PhD research, and then go watch her perform.
Jesus, you're teaching me stuff. All right, so what did you learn from this? I mean, what was your takeout?
My takeout is that one of the big things I really believe, and I've always thought this, but I know, you know, that experience, you know, you take experience versus your conditioned belief systems. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we all kind of grow up and we're told, don't do this, do that, do this. But once you start to experience things, there's a natural evolution that almost happens that can begin to override your beliefs. And it's interesting how, you know, she unpacks that in serious research.
You're saying that her, the story with her is that she's, once you go into porn, you think you know what you are and you think you know what you like, but the porn itself and being in the process of making it changes you?
Yeah, so she argues that it's because it's in the confines of safe spaces.
Yeah.
Like there are fantasies and experience that we all have that we'll never try because we never get a chance to have a structured, controlled environment. Ha. It's mind-blowing stuff, bro. Like, I wasn't ready for this. I ain't gonna lie. I was not ready for this at all.
This is amazing. It probably doesn't just extend to sex, though. It probably goes into all aspects of our lives. You know, you think I am a conservative, or you think I'm a liberal. And then when you're in a space where you can explore your real feelings about these things, and when you talk to people who are sometimes a bit smarter than you, sometimes they're the same as you, sometimes they're a bit dumber than you are in terms of your own understanding of the world, you could find out that you're actually nothing like the person you thought you were when you entered that.
Well, it happens all the time in race, right?
Yeah.
Like somebody will be like, oh, I've never met somebody from this region of the world. And you meet them, you're like, oh my God, we have so much in common. And they intrinsically light up something inside of you that you didn't know existed.
Hmm. All right, tell me quickly, because we haven't given your Fueling Futures a plug yet. And Fueling Futures is a leadership memoir that you wrote. And I wanted to talk about this weeks ago, and we're only getting around to it now. But under lockdown, this could be exactly the kind of thing people need.
Yeah, so I wrote, prior to this book, as you know, I sort of wrote four books about the psychology of personal branding, human behavior, and influence. And so I wanted to write a book that was essentially a case study. And I wanted to look at a young professional woman and her journey of simultaneously dealing with her own internal struggle while also working in a patriarchal environment in the fuel industry where there are literally no other men in her region doing what she does. So it was a case study of a young woman who had experienced enormous levels of sexual trauma, such as rape at an early age, and looking at how she now deals with being on the board. I mean, she's the first woman on the board of the rugby in Mpumalanga something. So so she's a very interesting character, and she comes from this, Matthews Poza is her father. Oh. So it was just an interesting story for me, you know, looking at how she's grappling with, you know, coming from this family that's quite controversial, et cetera. And so, you know, part of it was the father, you know, wanted to work with her to, you know, position her for the next chapter of their family's legacy, you know, to, you know, so I stumbled on this because I've always wanted to have a real practical case study and to sort of complement my work and my writing. So this was just an opportunity to do that.
It's terrific. And it's Tapiso Poza who you're talking about.
Yes.
That's an amazing story. And I reckon that that people should grab a copy of that if they want to see just how. And also, you weave together a bunch of different things. There's the psychological aspect of this. There's the personal branding part of it, which you're well versed in. There's some science in there as well. And then there's really just people telling their stories.
Yeah, I mean, she, you know, the idea is that if you can go to Amazon now and just search Fueling Futures, and that's two L's,
yeah,
because we had to use the UK version, which really traumatized me. but yeah, that was exactly the goal, Gareth. It was specifically to unpack her story and to show that there are these universal parallels that we all have to kind of overcome. And part of the reason why I did it was because she was seen as a person coming from privilege. I mean, her father's well known to be a billionaire. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to choose a black person who come from this billionaire background, who had this kind of privilege, to show that privilege does not protect you from certain patterns.
Yeah.
And so that was part of the goal, was to really unpack her humanity inside of this sort of billionaire environment, and then put her on the front lines of what it takes to be a woman working in a male environment, to neutralize this sort of some of these conversations we're having.
Timothy, you celebrated your birthday under lockdown, so all on your own. Did you make a birthday cake for yourself?
No, it was the day before lockdown.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah, it was. So I was celebrating the lockdown. You know, you know. Essentially, I had a neighbor come over, and we were a few feet apart. I don't know if we adhere to the distancing thing or not, but
shame. Shame, man. It's probably not even your favorite neighbor. It was just the only person who was around.
Exactly. I even said on a video I posted, she's in my top 50.
Does she know that, or she clearly knows that now?
Well, she knows it now, yeah. Yeah. She knows it now. Yeah,
so happy birthday for the, what was it, the 26th of March.
Yeah, absolutely. I share a birthday with Rena, which is a great, yeah.
Now, you also are writing an article. You're such an interesting guy to talk to. I could have you on here every day, and we'd never run out of things to talk about. You're writing an article about pandemics and the greatest pandemics in human history. So you've been doing some research. What have you picked up already? I don't want you to give away the substance of the article, but tell us more or less what you've learned and what we might be able to shortcut in terms of our experience of this one.
One of the things is, I'm not so interested in what pandemics do to society. I'm more interested in what pandemics do to thought leaders. And so in the Spanish flu of 1918, I looked at what happened in the UK. 1664. I've got all these pandemics in my head. The right. Bubonic plague of 1664 and what happened in the UK. And we looked at how Sir Isaac Newton left Cambridge and sort of initially self-quarantined at first. And he argues that it is the most rigorous intellectual period in his history.
Wow.
And it was the time where he literally discovered the theory of gravity. I mean, the theory that sort of undergirds what happens with optics. All of that. These are things he had been thinking about, but it was only during quarantine that he was able to unpack them and had the space. And to a point where when he came out of quarantine, his colleagues thought he was crazy. Like, this dude has literally lost his mind in quarantine.
Wow.
So, you know, the idea that quarantine can provide the space, I mean, some of the more funny things, like, you know, during the Great Depression, there were periods when people were quarantined on some level. And one of the great discoveries that came out of it was the chocolate chip cookie.
Right.
Hey, that's a necessity.
Damn straight.
Absolutely.
That is Sia's staple food. That's all he eats.
It's great innovation.
Yeah. So, I mean, come on, guys. I mean, I'm hoping the next chocolate chip cookie comes out of this whole 21 days.
One other thing while I've got you here, because this is something that happened in the news and you were quite outspoken about it. The whole Lady Zamar and Sjava rape saga, this idea of arousal incongruence. Do you just want to unpack this for us? Because I think it made a lot of sense, your take on the whole ugly situation. And maybe it helps other people to figure out the way forward in human relationships. Because we do have people who don't know anymore whether they're allowed to flirt, whether they're allowed to hit on someone, whether they're allowed to have sex, even though the other person has said, yeah, sure, I want to have sex with you. The rules have changed, man, and you got to help us figure this out.
Well, one of the let me give you some context on why I decided to comment. So firstly, I work with a gentleman that's working with Sjava. And so I've gotten to know a little bit about him from a distance. Mm-hmm. And also my ex was on a track with Lady Zamar. Oh, so wow. I got to know her a little bit. And so I found these two very interesting conscious characters playing out publicly. And once I read her statement, I was like, interesting. What happened was, she says they came back from a concert and they started making out. He went down on her orally, and, you know, when she consented to that, and then about halfway through, she was just like, you know, actually, I don't really want to do this. And that was the moment where she says the rape happened. So in my mind, I was like, let me sort of unpack a little bit some of what I've learned scientifically around what could have happened in her mind without actually going into the actual case and what could happen in other women's minds. So the broader sort of term for this is arousal non-concordance, when there's a fundamental gap. So for example, when I wake up with an erection, does not mean I want to have sex. If the wind blows on a woman's nipples and a guy sees it, it does not mean she's turned on by him. Yeah. Is that the physical reaction and what's happening in her psychology, there is no alignment. There's incongruence, there's non-concordance. And so I was basically suggesting that it's possible in a case like this that her being physically wet and aroused did not mean that she wanted to continue to have penetrative sex. And I was, my goal was to help to share some insight for people who go, when I see a bodily reaction, that does not mean I should pursue, despite what the person is saying.
Yeah, but then what the hell do you know? Because if they're saying yes or if they're saying no, I take that as a straightforward instruction, and that's about consent, right?
Yeah.
So what their body's doing is almost completely unimportant.
Yeah, well, but we're not conditioned that way. I mean, we are. This is the point: is that we're conditioned in so many ways, because remember, most of my decisions, and this is why it interests me, most of my decisions are, by the way, are you home?
Yeah.
Is this your house?
Yeah.
And whose books are, who's all these encyclopedias?
My
books. You're too young to have all these encyclopedias.
My books.
I feel like you're in an 18th century.
I had a set of encyclopedias when I was a kid, and we'll get back to the Lady Zamar thing in a moment, but that was my... It was my favorite thing to do, is just open it up somewhere and just read about a word that I didn't know at all. And I'm telling you now, that stuff may be useless to everyone else, but I love it because someone will bring something up in a conversation and I'll go, oh, I know where that's a part of that's a part of the Dacian coast in Croatia. You know?
Got it. Okay,
so
cool.
So I actually read these things. They're not there for show.
Okay, cool. So what I was fascinated by, and a lot of it is, a lot of it has to do with my own experience. And for example, okay, I'm going to get real personal here. So I was in Cape Town at a women's conference. After I was flirting back and forth with this woman who was also on a panel that I was speaking on. Things got really intense in our engagement. We go back to my room later on. We started making out. I mean, it literally got so forceful that she was like biting. There was bruising on my back. It was intense. Then I whip out a condom and she smacks me. And she says, no. And then she says no a couple times. And you know, there's these different no's. There's these different sort of like, no, try hard or stupid.
Yeah.
Or no. And so I was really tired. So in my mind, I'm going, you're fairly well known. So if I get this no wrong, my career is over. Yeah. So I just stop. I stop. Anyway, we fall asleep, wake up in the morning. As she's walking out, she's at the door. And before she shuts it, she looks at me. She says, why didn't you take it? You knew I needed it.
Wow. You didn't know, though. How you meant, what are you meant to read her mind?
Okay, so this is my point. So this has set me out on this journey to study this arousal non-concordance is navigating between the psychology and the bodily response is something that we're almost inherently wired to try to figure out, but no one teaches us how to do it. So this Zamar case sort of triggered this sort of reminder around this research I had gone on where trying to understand my own experiences and try to understand, you know, what and why some of this, I think some of the Me Too moment happens because of this. Mm-hmm. I've looked at a lot of these cases and I've looked at some people that I really admire who's fallen into so much drama. And I really think at some point that there were these moments where these, you know, decent human beings found themselves in a situation where they were, you know, they were on this track that said, we're going to go this far. And then at some point, a woman's psychology changed. And then the ego and the internal kind of male, you know, conditioning did not turn back. And no one talks about the fact that once you're like 75% there, how do you self-regulate? How do you self-regulate? How do you begin calming the primitive beast that has now been awakened? And so we just sort of write it off and go, oh, you need to deal with yourself. That's not my problem, et cetera. And I'm not saying this happens all the time. I do know that there are manipulative men who use their power without any sort of, you know, runway that anyone has gone down. I'm simply saying that I really feel a lot of men got down this journey and did not know how to self-regulate or did not have the resources mentally and the training to know how to self-regulate.
Yeah, but there's a responsibility on both parties here to say what they mean and to mean what they say. Otherwise, I see so many situations where take sex out of it for a second. You know how many times women will say to men, but you should know that that's what I meant. Like we have some kind of mind reading skill or some seventh or eighth sense that we're meant to just know. You know, when a woman says, oh, no, it's fine. And you say, oh, all right, well, then it's fine. They don't mean that. That is deceit. No, it's deceitful. And if we're going to communicate effectively and if men are going to be held criminally responsible for not communicating effectively, then there need to be consequences on both sides. In other words, enough of this bullshit of, you're meant to be able to read my mind, and if you love me and if you can feel me, you should know. We've got to be direct, and you've got to take the romance the hell out of this, and we've got to start being honest with each other.
Yeah, you know, you sound like you sound like one of the elders in the community.
Am I wrong?
I mean, listen, let's evolve this conversation a little bit. So my next book, which I think it's either going to redefine my career and it's going to take me on a new journey or it'll be a colossal failure and I'll be a has-been. I don't know which one. But what I am hoping to do in this next book, which is entitled Arouse, is to talk about the science of why we lie and pursuing an understanding of the truth around what happens internally. Now, let's pick up on what you're saying. What happens is during adolescence, you know, so we are conditioned from like 1 to 10 years old to follow specific sort of patterns. and it's logic patterns. You put your hands on a stove, and what does that mean? That means that I'm going to get burnt. So me plus this stove equals burnt. Mm-hmm. And you just follow these sort of logic patterns.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the hormones kick in adolescence, and now nothing makes sense. Like, what I've been taught to do, what I've been taught to say, nothing's making sense. All of a sudden, I see this thing, and now I am bone hard, and I'm told that that's wrong. Now you got this chaos happening, and nobody tells you how to deal with it, Gareth.
Yeah.
And so, no one. And then all of a sudden, we become adults, and we walk around all with these erect, sophisticated postures, and have no clue how to reconcile what's happening between the environment, what's happening in our psychology, and what we're socially conditioned to do. Wow. And so I wanted to step into that space and offer some insight as neuroscience, behavioral science evolves to help us understand decision-making, understanding why we respond to so many things. Like, one of my favorite things that I've come across recently is this concept called noise and how, so one of the next, Daniel Kahneman's next book is going to be about noise. And he was intrigued by how wine sommeliers were tricked into giving the same sort of wine, and they were rating the same exact wine differently, mm-hmm. because they tasted at different times of the day, or they tasted the specific wine they had just rated after. So what they tasted right after would impact how they tasted the wine originally, and that's called noise. And so I'm interested in
N-O-I-S-E, noise.
Yes, just like noise. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so this sort of scientific moment, I really believe around noise, when he publishes his work, is really going to change a lot about how we think about what happens sexually, even. Like, you know, what is some of the noise that could potentially alter how we feel in a moment? I'll give you an example. And this is something that I really balked at. And this is probably the most controversial thing that will happen in this conversation at the moment.
Yeah.
So there was a 6'9" basketball player who had consensual sex. He even recorded the girl saying yes. And later on, she changed her mind. And she says that, you know, she felt like she was raped. And then what came up in court was, is it possible that she did not have the internal faculty and the capacity to say no to such an imposing presence? Now, I know that's highly uncomfortable for any man or any woman. Like, that's uncomfortable to think about. Wait. I'm not saying he's guilty. So let's not rush to that conclusion. I'm simply saying it poses an interesting, like, there's great studies about how difficult it is to say no. Well, I forget which podcast is on, I'll share it with you. But there's some really good research about how we're not trained to say no. So if we're in public and people come up to you, in fact, organizations who are trying to raise money right now should know that it's very difficult for people to say no right now in this pandemic. So people overdetermine how easy it is to say, you know, to say no in a moment. And so what that led me down was an interesting look at, what does it take to position yourself to be able to say no in the presence of pressure?
Yeah, but Timothy, in the presence of pressure, if someone says to me, okay, we're going to feed you to a lion now, the appropriate response, no matter how imposing the person is who's asking that, is to say no. And if you don't stand up for yourself and you get eaten by the lion, you've opted in. And I'm afraid this is where, and it's about maybe standing up for yourself, maybe it's about confidence, maybe it's about doing the right thing. I don't know what those things are. But it seems almost like we're making excuses for, and I'm by no means condoning that there are, you know, that when someone is it incapable of saying something, let's say they're under huge duress or something, that isn't something to be considered. I'm so glad, by the way, we're not talking about coronavirus at the moment. God, this is such a relief.
Let me just say this quickly, Gareth.
But why are you saying that someone who's maybe for good reason, but maybe also just too weak to say no, should be considered a victim when they're opting in to something which they could easily just say no to?
I, No, I never said that. I said that what I'm interested in is what are the internal mechanisms required to give a person the confidence to say no? Like, what is the wiring? So you speak very sort of forcefully with a lot of conviction. What part of you having these encyclopedias, what part of your height, what part of all of these sort of structures enable you? What part of a person's background? When I think about my own background, when I moved from a farm to New York and how my exposure to New York gave me so much more confidence as a human being, and my conditioning on a farm left me with certain strengths, but I was vulnerable in other areas because there was not much stimuli. And the pace of stimuli and the much slower pace of stimuli exposed me to certain vulnerability. So I'm interested in the internal workings. And this is where I'm writing another piece about privilege and how I'm grappling with my own privilege. So for example, you know, in South Africa, as an American, when I walk and I step on stage, oftentimes, particularly before Trump, when I spoke, there was an ease, and my accent was a privilege. And there are other times when my accent gets me into a lot of trouble, and it's not a privilege. So I've been exploring the mechanisms of privilege and then how that impacts and how we're received in society and so forth.
Yeah, wow. This is so interesting. I almost think that we should devote another show or two to this. But I do want to quickly ask you before we have to go. In lockdown, you're on your own now. Is it important to keep connected? You talked about Isaac Newton and how he went into quarantine and that helped him write these brilliant Principia Mathematica and things like that. Now, what about connecting to the rest of humanity during this time? Have you been trying your best to stay connected to people? Are you FaceTiming? Are you talking to family? Or are you're totally buying into this lockdown and you're throwing yourself into reading?
So everyone is different. Some people are not able to meditate. Some people, you know, they're able to meditate, but they don't. So they're not aware. They need noise. They need a lot of sort of external stimuli. So you got to know where you are on the kind of scale. So for me personally, I'm working on this new book. I'm trying to, by the end of 21 days, trying to have my first draft out. You know, I've started working on it before, but my goal is to push towards at least 80% of the first draft. So yes, I mean, I do connect a little bit, but probably at 10% of the rate that most people are. But I'm perfectly content and I'm really enjoying it. In fact, each day, I've got a friend in the Bahamas who is on day 9 of the lockdown. And he says every day just gets easier if you have a plan. And I found that yesterday flew by, like to a point where it was uncomfortable how fast it went by. Whereas the first couple of days, it was just like a snail's pace. So I think if you have a plan and you have some sort of goal that takes you through the 21 days, that helps irrespective of how you feel.
That's great. Okay. That is terrific advice. Yeah, thank you. Timothy Maurice, it's always a pleasure to speak to you, man. Have a good lockdown. I hope you
I'm going to come hang out. I'm sorry. I was going to say, I'm going to come hang out and check out some of your encyclopedias sometime.
they aren't all just encyclopedias, by the way. You're just looking at the one shelf. I got a bunch of shit here.
Oh, wow. Amazing. Good stuff, bro.
All right. Nice to speak to you, sir. Always good. There's Timothy Maurice, everybody. Okay, what's coming up next? Well, we've got Sivengesi, who is a well-known character to the show as well. Sivengesi is a celebrity. He's an actor. I bumped into him in New York last year, and we had a great catch-up in New York, and he's back in South Africa. He's got lots of projects on the go, and he seems to be one of those people who's just, like Timothy, is buoyed by this lockdown. Most of us are kind of nervous about what it means, and we're not sure, but Siv and Timothy, they're just lapping it up. So you'll hear from him in a moment in Living in Lockdown. It's our new series on cliffcentral.com. Thanks for joining us this morning. We will see you tomorrow, bright and early at 6 o'clock, hopefully with no technical difficulties. And look after yourself today. Stay healthy, stay safe.
Cliffcentral.com.